Welcome. This is the Abstraction Podcast, a talk show about the philosophy of science, mathematics, economics, society, technology, consciousness, and other things. I'm Sina. I'm here with Pedram.
Hello.
So, Pedram, we've been a while since we last spoke. We've been busy. I got married. So that's a big thing, I guess.
No, it is.
It's definitely a big thing. And you had a big seminar yesterday, which we don't have to talk about unless you want to talk about it.
Oh, it was a departmental seminar.
Uh-huh. What was the point of it?
You're required to have three of them as a requisite to graduate. Uh-huh. It's just to prepare you if you want to choose a career in academia, to prepare you to give talks at conferences and stuff, to just better prepare you to best explain your ideas to not only an audience that's keen on what you do research on, but also lay audiences, how to best explain complicated ideas in simple terms, but not too simple in a sense to cheat your audience.
Right. So do you want to quickly, like 30 seconds, what your topic was on? I mean, I attended, right?
Yes.
So I followed, I would say 50% of it.
I discussed two topics. I'll explain the main one. The main one is on a topic called time-resolved crystallography. In a sense, it's when you attain structures of proteins, they're static. It's like a snapshot in time.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if you had a car engine running and you had a high-speed camera and you took multiple snapshots as the engine does its thing, you're able to then have static composites of what the engine is doing at a certain point in time. From that, you can try to piece together how the engine actually functions. That's essentially what it is.
Yeah, okay, that's cool. All right, well, I didn't do anything like that, so I was just living life, I suppose, busy. So this is our third episode, and here's the thing. We did two episodes. The first one was on science. What is science? How does it work? Second one was on math. What is math? And we tried to, that's the emphasis. We tried to sort of show the connection between how science works and math works and how they work together to do this whole process of learning about the universe. I think that we didn't do a pretty good job of explaining. I think we didn't do a good job of explaining math well, and secondly, explaining the connection between how science and math work. So I thought maybe we should just try again, at least for a little bit, to maybe bridge that gap, fill in the details that maybe we missed. Okay, so let's just recap on what we said. First of all, we said, let's talk about science first. We said science is very simple. We said science is about not figuring out what's true, it's about figuring out what's not true. And so you do that by doing experiments and you falsify things and or verify them. But when you verify them, you're not actually showing that something is true. You're just verifying it. And the whole way the science works is by falsifying. So you basically are figuring all the things that aren't true, and whatever's left over is true. And how math works, math is more of about deduction, about logical inference. So math is about taking what you know to be true, what you assume to be true, and saying, if those things are true, what else is true? Okay, that's what we said. And when you combine those two things, you get the best of both worlds. So in math, you can only do math if you have some prior assumptions of what is true, and then you figure out what else is true. But you still have to figure out what are those axioms, it's called in mathematics. And that's the role that science has. It helps you pick which are the axioms that you are going to assume to be true. But at the same time, science is never saying that those axioms are true. It's saying these are the best guesses at the current time. And science never says that something is 100% true, everything is possibly false. As you move forward, hopefully you become less wrong, your assumptions become better, and that's how science works. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. You try to piece together the best possible explanation from the facts you have.
Mm-hmm.
And if a fact arises that contradicts the model you have, well, then you have to modify the model or completely throw it out, depending on what it is, to encompass all the data you have.
Mm-hmm.
You can make partial models to describe portions of facts and portions of your data. However, to be all-encompassing and to explain large systems, you have to try to come up with a theory or the best explanation to explain all the data without too much variation.
Right. Right. And the one way to word it is to say that in science is that you don't know what's true, you only know what's false. And instead of knowing what's true, you know what works. So you have two categories, things that you know to be false and things that you know they work. Right? There's no such thing as these are the things that are true. In science, there's no such thing as these are the collection of items that are true. In a very strict sense. Of course, you have things that you've tried a million times and they seem to keep working. And those are those theories that, you know, you're not sure they're true, but they seem to keep working and they work better than other things. And those are sort of your scientific consensus. Those are the things that those are scientific quote facts, but they're not
these
actual
are,
facts.
Yeah, exactly. Right? The scientific truths are more in the sense of scientific theory. There are facts that a truth is based on, i.e. it's a fact that, a fact of science is that we are made up of cells.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
In a sense, right?
In a sense, yes. a scientific theory such as cell theory is a composite of facts, and it's the best explanation we can come up with to explain those facts.
And we say it's a fact because we really think that. Like, we're not like, okay, sure, it could, maybe we're really wrong. We've been doing this thing. We've been doing this whole cell theory of life wrong. And all this evidence we have that's consistent and we think works is wrong, but we really do think that. Okay. So I want to stress that when I say we don't know what's true, it's not like we're sitting here saying that we don't know anything. We think we know things. We think we made progress. We think we understand life in the sense of it being comprised of cells, but hey, it could be wrong. We don't know. Right. We're never completely 100%.
Or it could be right. Partially right.
And that's the science side, right? That's the science side. The math side comes in and it helps science. And it says, because the way to do science is you have a theory and then you have to disprove, you have to try to disprove it. And if you can't disprove it, then it's a good theory. Not disprove it, you falsify it.
I would cut that. You have a hypothesis that you have to disprove.
Well, I'm not going to cut it out. I'm going to keep this in. But why do you distinguish between hypothesis and theory?
Because a theory is based on experimentation. A theory is a conglomerate
of
multiple experiments, tests, hypotheses, etc.
Okay.
Cell theory, or the theory of evolution, theory of gravity,
right,
is based on multiple experiments, multiple different hypotheses. A single experiment is testing a single hypothesis.
Okay, I mean, it's semantics. Like,
it is semantics.
So I'll give you that. But if in the future of this episode and this podcast, I say theory, I use those indistinguishably. So I say theory and
hypothesis. Fair.
But anyways, okay. So you have a hypothesis and you try to disprove the hypothesis, and if you can't disprove it, that's a good hypothesis. And a theory, which is a collection of hypotheses, if you can't disprove that, you can't falsify it, then that's a good theory, right?
It's more accurate.
Yes, I know. But that's the whole idea. Yes. A good theory is one that you can't destroy.
More difficult to vary.
Yeah. And the thing is, there will be competing theories that will be good in different situations, and ones will be easier to destroy than others in certain situations.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And what I want to say is how math, the role math plays in this whole thing is that when you come up with a scientific theory or a scientific hypothesis, when you want to test it, you have to test it against observable things. Do you agree? You with me?
Yes.
Like that's what an experiment is.
That's exactly.
Right? Yes. If you can't observe it, it's not an experiment. And so one of the roles math plays is, well, you have a scientific theory and you use math to come up, well, what are the consequences of that theory? So an example would be like the theory of gravity, right? So Newtonian's theory of gravity. Well, you can't actually, at first at least, you can't, because it's a new theory, you can't actually observe things like force, And you can't actually observe the things. Wait, just Petram just gave a look, but let me finish and then you can tell him. Just hear me out.
Okay.
So you can't actually observe something, a thing like force or mass at first, right? But you have this theory of gravity, of how, you know, gravity, there's this force between mass, you know, two objects with different mass and different distance apart. And what you can do, you do is use math to figure out, well, what are the consequences of that theory. So one is that, well, a simple one is just, you know, you drop an apple and it falls to the earth. Okay, fine, whatever. But that doesn't really help prove the theory. A better one is you can work out the consequences of the theory to show that, well, planetary objects will move in an ellipse around, like, say, the sun. And you can work that out. And once you, and then, and you can try to observe that, right?
Yes.
And that's your experiment. And you doing that experiment, you either verify the theory of gravity or you falsify it. It turns out that we couldn't falsify it at that point. It was, you know, observing planetary motion. It verified the theory of gravity. And that was the role that math played in it, right? So you had this theory. You want to disprove it or verify it. But to disprove it or verify it, it needs to be, you need to know what are the consequences that are observable. And that's where math can come in, where it can say, well, okay, you have these assumptions, right? Because this is what math is. You have assumptions. Well, what else is true? Okay, so you have this theory. Well, what else is true? What are the consequences that I can observe, right? So that I can actually do an experiment to figure it out.
That's a very apt description,
right? Yeah.
Of the relationship between, yeah, the two.
And I mean, like, to be clear, I want to clarify that it's not like this. When you actually do this in practice, it's not like you're doing one and then the other, or there's, it's not like they're really distinguished. You know, I'm trying to separate them so that we can better understand it, but you're doing it all at once. Yes. Like, for example, let me give you an example of something like pi, the number pi, which is the ratio between the circumference and diameter of a circle. And you know, we know what pi is very precisely now through mathematics, right? Because we've sort of worked out what, you know, given some assumptions we have about geometry and the world and these kind of stuff, we use mathematics to take those assumptions, those basic assumptions and axioms, and figure out, well, pi is approximately, you know, there's so many ways to approximate it, but, you know, you can create a series. There's so many ways, but you can precisely define it and figure out what pi is to a very high decimal places, 3.14, whatever it is. But you could have also figured out what pi was scientifically, which was actually the first way that pi was first estimated by, say, the Babylonians, who I think they approximated pi like 3.16 or something. I don't know what it was, but you could do that very easily in a scientific sense by doing an experiment. You draw a circle as best as you can. You measure the diameter as best as you can. You measure the circumference as best as you can. You take the ratio and you get some number, right? That's, see the difference between the two, mm-hmm, of figuring out the value of that value of pi, the two processes. One of the scientific processes is like, you just do it, build it and measure it. The mathematical way says, let me start with some things that I believe are very true, and I'm not second guessing them. I really think these are the case, and let me use those to logically work out what pi must therefore be, right?
Yes.
So there's that. So that's science and math, but this is all going on at the same time, right? So first you might come up with an estimate for pi using the scientific way, but then you find a way to estimate it in a mathematical way with some more fundamental axioms, some more fundamental assumptions, and that feeds back on itself. So now you have better mathematical language to describe the world, so you can construct better scientific theories, right? And you construct better scientific theories, it means that your underlying axioms get better, which means you can apply mathematics to these underlying axioms better to find out what other consequences are. That feeds back on to the scientific process that says, okay, now I can do science better. So it just, you keep going, it happens continuously, it just keeps going. So it's not like we actually break it down and do this necessarily in some sort of linear fashion. It's just, they're both interacting with each other all the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
You think so? So I think what I want to do is I hope that's clear to people, like the difference between math and science. Science is about experiment. It's about disproving things. It's about falsifying and or verifying. It's about, like, it's more about figuring something out just by doing it, constructing it and measuring, right?
Yes.
Whereas mathematics is about, well, let me take the fundamental things that I assume to be true, and I'm not even going to worry about them because they're so basic. I couldn't believe they're possibly wrong.
And compute their consequences.
Exactly, and figure out what else is true. And that's the difference, and they both work with each other. They're both necessary to create this process that I don't even think has a name. So it's not the scientific method or the mathematical method. It's sort of the combination of the two to advance our knowledge of the world. So what I wanted to do is, you know, to really narrow, to really solidify it to anyone listening, is to talk about, just let's apply it to something as simple as, what is the shape of the Earth, right? And this is a good example because people can visualize it. So if you were sitting, if you were like living 10,000 years ago in a nomadic tribe as a hunter-gatherer, right? Mm-hmm. And you were just going around and you were observing the world, you would think, and you'd be right actually, I know we might laugh at that, but you would think the world is flat. Because based on all your observational data that you get from living in this world, you would say, okay, the world is flat. And you, starting with that, you could actually, so that's a scientific result, right? And using that, you would, if you wanted to use math, you would take, say, okay, assuming the world is flat, what are the other consequences? What are the consequences of the world if the world is flat?
Parallel lines will continue to be
exactly.
Parallel.
So this is Euclid, right? So Euclid, in his, you know, famous Euclid's Elements, he tried to do this, right? He basically pretty much, Euclid's Elements is about taking, assuming the world is flat, let's figure out all the consequences of it. And he had five assumptions to do all this. And you can, they're very famous, you can look them up or whatever. One of them is the famous one that two parallel lines never meet. And you can create a whole, you know, flat world geometry on this, figure out all the consequences mathematically, not scientifically. So you're not actually going out and, you know, creating these shapes or creating these lines or doing anything. You're sitting there and you're using mathematics, you're using logical deduction, you're thinking about it to figure out, okay, the world is flat, I'm gonna assume that using these five postulates. Now what else is true? And that would work very well. It would work very well. On a regular daily basis, the world really is flat. It's not a joke. The world is flat.
On a small scale.
On a small scale. Okay, so fine. But then, so exactly. So then what happens is you've noticed the world is flat. You work out all the consequences. You have this really rich defined theory that allows you to predict everything in the world. Not everything. Well, exactly. As much, everything that you can observe around you, this theory works of a flat world. Until one day it doesn't, right? One day you do some sort of... Something happens.
Some experiment or you make some observation that points to a conclusion that maybe the world isn't flat.
And so like it's something like Pythagoras' theorem, right? So Pythagoras' theorem, I hope everyone knows, is the theorem about right angle triangles, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. And that's actually a consequence of Euclid's five postulates, right? So Pythagoras' theorem, so actually let me interject. Pythagoras' theorem is another example of this whole idea of doing something the science way and the mathematical way. So even before Euclid ever worked this out, or even before Pythagoras worked this out in mathematics, people knew Pythagoras' theorem, the fact that on a right angle triangle, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, simply by observing it through science, simply through observation and experiment. What they did is they constructed right angle triangles, and they measured them, and they noticed that pattern. Now, step in Euclid, and he wants to figure out all the consequences of a flat world on these five postulates, and it turns out that Pythagoras' theorem is one of them, right?
Yeah.
So you have two, right? Anyway, so that was just a sidebar. Anyway, so you have Pythagoras' theorem from this flat world theory you've developed, right? You have all the consequences you can have of a flat world. Pythagoras' theorem is one of them, and then... one day, somehow, somewhere, things don't work so well. Like, for example, over long distances, you find that if you assume the world is flat, that some of your measurements keep coming out wrong. And it's not that they keep coming out wrong, it's that they keep coming out like consistently wrong, right? They're wrong in a consistent way. And it's really strange. You can't figure out what's going on here. And so you have this problem where the world is flat. It looks flat. It seems to be flat. You have this theory of a flat Earth. You've worked out all the consequences. It all seems to work. It works in so many places. You build your you construct your farm area around it, you design buildings around it, you're measuring all kinds of things, but then one day it stops working, especially over long distances. And so it turns out your theory is not perfect. It's kind of wrong. And eventually you come up with a new theory and you say, well, okay, the Earth isn't flat. It's a sphere, right? And it's a very large sphere, right? So when you're sitting on top of a very large sphere, it looks flat. And not even looks flat, it really does behave flat. Like it really, it is approximately flat. It really is. But at a large enough scale, it matters that that it's a sphere and that it's curved. So you come up with this, you have this new theory of a spherical Earth. And then, okay, now you apply math again. You do all the consequences. You figure out, okay, well, if the Earth is sphere, what has to be true? You test those out. It works. It works so well, time and time and time again. And you keep doing this process, right? So eventually you come out and you find that actually the spherical Earth doesn't work too well for certain things. I don't even know why it would not work. I can't even say. But something comes along the way where you're like, actually, no, given how this thing works or this thing I've observed, it can't be because the Earth is sphere. I mean, the Earth can't be spherical. It has to be a different shape. And maybe you say, oh, actually, it's not a sphere. It's an ellipsoid, which is it's like an oval, but in three dimensions,
yeah. Right?
Or like an ellipse, but in
or
three dimensions.
Or an oblate spheroid, basically a compressed sphere at the poles.
Mm. Right. So, But the point is, it's kind of like a sphere, except now it's a little bit more different, right?
Yes.
Right? And you keep doing this process. So you have a flat Earth, work out the consequences. It's great. Then it doesn't work. Well, okay, fine. Let me make the theory better or figure out what's really going on. Oh, it's sphere. Okay, well, that makes sense because at a local level, that means a flat Earth works. But if I zoom out large enough, then it becomes spherical and I have to start considering it that way. But then you find out one day, oh, no. You know, the way the Earth is spinning or whatever, it couldn't possibly be spherical. Now it's an ellipsoid. Okay, well, now you update yourself. And then you keep going. In fact, the Earth isn't a perfect ellipsoid. It's rough around the edges. There are mountains, there are valleys, there are all these kind of things, right? So your theory just keeps getting better and better and better.
Your math keeps getting better and better and better.
Yeah, and the math gets better at describing it, right? So you actually have to invent new mathematics to describe these new theories. Like, for example, that one postulate that you said, two parallel lines never meet, which is true in a flat world. It's not necessarily true in a curved world. Well, it depends how you define parallel at that point. But that my point is, you know, you see what I'm saying? So you have to now, you know, to explain the world as it gets, you learn more about it, you have to actually develop new mathematics to do it.
The more you try to begin to understand the world you live in, mm-hmm. the more you have to refine your language, which is mathematics. Mm-hmm. The better you refine your language, the better you can describe the world you live in with that language.
Yeah, I agree. But you can see, I mean, this is the good lesson that, you know, we didn't throw out our theory of a flat Earth, and we didn't throw out our theory of a spherical Earth, right? Like even now today, you know, like a civil engineer constructing a bridge isn't doing spherical geometry mathematics.
Oh, absolutely.
To do that, they're using flat Earth, right? They're assuming a flat Earth.
Newton's laws are wrong in terms of high energies, mm-hmm. high speeds, fast speeds, etc., but they work and they're highly accurate in the context of the world where they were developed. Mm-hmm. We still use Newton's laws to send satellites into space. They were used to send the astronauts to the moon. We did not need to use Einstein's theory of relativity mm-hmm. to send astronauts mm-hmm. to the moon. It is not necessary. They are completely accurate for what they are suited for.
They're accurate enough.
Yes, they are. Yeah. Exactly. They are accurate enough for the experiments that they're suited for.
Totally.
And they are accurate now and they'll be accurate till the end of time.
Well, hopefully.
Yes.
Because that's another thing. And we're getting into the weeds here. But you know, one of the presumptions is that the laws don't change.
Yes, that's a huge...
Right? But what if the laws do change? Well, if they do change, what we need is a background law that explains these changing laws, right? And those are constant. So you get into this cycle. Anyways, we don't need to talk about that. But anyways, my point is, I think this is a good example, like applying, you know, science and math to the shape of the earth, you really get to see this is how it works in every field, right? I think this is a good example because people can understand it and visualize it. But this is how it works. Like you started with a flat earth, and that really did explain the world at that time. And you worked out all the consequences, and you figured it out, and you figured out how triangles work and circles work and how they all, the areas and this and that. Great. But then it stops working in some places, and you expand it, and you assume the earth is spherical, and that fixes your theories in those places where it didn't work. But you don't throw out the flat earth, and when you don't need to use the theory of a spherical earth, you don't do it, right? Like when you want to just figure out the distance from one point of the city to another, you don't incorporate the curvature that's there. It's there. That curvature is there between point A and point B, between two points in a city, but you don't need to because it's so small that you just assume it's flat and it all works out. You don't need to, right? So the theory is technically wrong of a flat earth, even though some people think that it really is just flat and there's no spherical part, but that's...
They're crazy.
Yes, they're crazy. But they're not crazy in the sense that, no, it's flat here. Like, you can just keep using it. There's no reason why you can't use it until you want to imagine you want to put satellites in space, GPS satellites. And now, okay, you can't use a flat earth theory. It's not going to work. Your GPS satellites, everything will fall apart. You have to now assume spherical earth. Right?
Yes.
So I think people can now visualize what we mean by applying science and math and the difference between the two, I think, to the process. And again, I mean, this whole thing happens, it's not like it's not like scientists and mathematicians sit there and they take turns or anything like that. This is all happening continuously. And also, there's not like there's a difference between a scientist and a mathematician per se. Scientists do math and mathematicians do science, right? These are like, I'm trying to distinguish them here so we can better understand it. So we can say, oh, here we're applying this process. Oh, here we're applying this process. So we can really understand when we know something. When I say, oh, I know that there are electrons and they do this. What do I mean by I know? Which are the things, how do I know? What are the things that I know through science, through experiment? What are the things I know because I computed the consequences, not because I actually did the experiment, but I used mathematics to figure it out. That doesn't mean that's not true. It's still likely very true, just right? But I did a different process. Like a good, just a very simple example is if I were to ask you, if I had 1 trillion apples and I added another trillion apples, how many apples would you have? And you'd say 2 trillion apples. And I would say, okay, that's math, you know, though. That's not science. Because you never, ever took 1 trillion apples, counted them all, and then counted another trillion apples, and then put them together, and then counted that to see if it became 2 trillion apples, right? You're using mathematics to figure that out based on very fundamental assumptions of how numbers work, how counting apples works, which you did at lower numbers of apples. And you just figured out the consequences. If 1 + 1 = 2, then 1 apple plus 1 apple equals 2 apples, then 1 trillion apples plus 1 trillion apples has to be 2 trillion apples, right? Anything you want to add to that?
No, I think you described it quite succinctly.
Okay. So that's math, that's science. They're different, but they're the same. They work together. So did I tell you I went to I attended a class today on the philosophy of science. It's a class at University of Toronto.
No, I didn't know that.
I just went to the class. I just sat in on the lecture. It was interesting. It was actually good. So I went to two this week. One was just 2 days ago. I went. It was on. I think the class is called Knowledge and Meaning, and I thought it would be interesting because it's sort of the stuff that we're talking about. But it really wasn't. But today's class, which was a class, the title of the class is the Introductory to Philosophy of Science, was a lot more about what we talk about. I just thought I'd tell you. I think it's interesting. I think I'll keep going back, seeing what they say. It's not too different than what we're talking about. The way they approach it, I noticed, this is a philosophy class, by the way, so it's not done in a math department or science department. It's done in a philosophy department. Actually, a philosophy of science department. Anyway. The way they sort of approach it is they mostly talk about what different people said about science and how it's changed over time, how people think about science,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think we really want to talk about. I think we want to talk about what is the best way to think about science, which is what we're describing. I just thought I'd tell you. I thought it was interesting.
Oh, yes. Most science is conducted in the way, like, based on falsification. Now, there are, from my understanding, although I'm not in this field, that specifically the way theoretical physics is being pushed, it's getting to the point where doing the experiments that you would require to test certain theories in theoretical physics would take much, much, much longer mm-hmm. than it would to come up with a whole bunch of theories. Now, how would you know if the theories that you're proposing are actually scientific? Now, there's
new... Let's stop you there for a second. So what you're saying, instead of having this one theory that will take a long time to experiment, they're just breaking it down into 10 different theories. What do you mean?
No. So let's say there are, when I say not explain one thing, but you have, so certain theories in cosmology and stuff are not testable so far with respect to the right. technology we
But it
have.
Could be tested in principle.
It can be tested in principle.
So that's still science, though. Then.
No, it is still science. Right. But are the theories that are proposed are in theoretical physics, are those theories still considered scientific, even though we cannot test them right now?
We can't test. So what do you think?
There's branches in the philosophy of science that try to address these
yeah.
things. So you can't falsify mathematical theories in theoretical physics, because that's the only way we can falsify them is with experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So is falsification the best route to take in the world of theoretical physics?
But are they proposing some other way? How do you, like, if not falsifying, what are you, how are you calibrating with the real world if you're not doing...
You base it on existing evidence and you constrain your theories based on how the world works, not how you want it to be. And I'm going to butcher this, but they have to be self-consistent in the sense that they have to make sense not only in a mathematical framework, but they have to make sense especially in a physical framework. The theories cannot propose things that are so wild that we cannot ever test them.
So you're saying that... Yeah, so here's the question. So here,
for example, like there are many theories for the interpretation of quantum mechanics, right? There's Copenhagen interpretation, there's the many worlds interpretation. Now, how do we know which one's true? Well, we don't know which one's true. And many of them, I have no idea how you'd even begin to test, like the many worlds theory.
So now, if you can't test it, is it false? Is it science, right?
Exactly. Now, I'm not saying that you can't eventually come up with a yes. method to test it. Yep. That may very well be possible.
I agree.
But just because one doesn't exist now doesn't mean one won't
okay.
exist.
Okay, so they actually talked about this in the class today. And I took objection with the professor. So let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
So he was saying that in order for a theory to be scientific, it has to be at least in principle, even if you don't know, you can't do the experiment now, or it's too expensive, or whatever it is. But in principle, you should be able to do an experiment and falsify it, to try to falsify it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that makes a theory scientific. And so he said you can break theories down into ones that are scientific and unscientific. So the ones that are scientific are ones where you can at least in principle come up with an experiment to verify or falsify it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says ones that you can't do that are unscientific. And I took issue with that because I said, wait, how do you know, just because you haven't come up with the experiment, how do you know there is no such experiment? That to me is so anti-scientific, right? And I said, a better way to word it is, separate the two is to say, here are theories that are scientific because I've come up with a way to test them. And here are the ones that are ambiguous. I haven't yet figured out a way. I haven't yet figured out a way to test it. Maybe there is, but I don't know what it is. So I don't know. What do you think about that? Like, I thought that was very...
I agree with you. You can also have a third category, which is we will eventually come to the point where we know we cannot test certain theories.
Right.
Then you can have a theory of... you can have a category of unknowns
mm-hmm.
where you can make plausibility mm-hmm. statements and stuff. based on the trend of what we see, this theory can be true, but there's no way we can test it based on some physical constraints of our universe. But insofar as my understanding of these branches of science go, and I am far from these branches of science, so excuse me if I get this wrong, there are very few theories that come out that do not have at least the potential of eventually being tested, not probably now, but well into the future. Now, that's not to say that everything that gets published is possibly right. No, most things that get published in theoretical physics are more often than not wrong. They are self-consistent mathematically. Yes, but
that is a good word, self-consistent.
But eventually through testing and stuff, or experiment, you find out that no, these proposed theories are wrong. But then the other theories that have been proposed are now more likely to be right. They are not right in the sense, but they haven't yet to be falsified, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And no, I think that's a great example of what we mean, the difference between science and math. So these are new theoretical
frameworks.
Theoretical frameworks, there are new theories of physics, right? And they're described in a mathematical way. And they're self-consistent because that's what math is. Math is like, tells you what is consistent and not consistent. And so these theories are theories that are consistent with what we have and the things we're trying to explain. But they're not at that point, they're just math. Right? At that point, they're just mathematical frameworks. Until you're able to test them and verify them or falsify them, then it becomes, that's applying science to it, and then and that's how you eventually calibrate it back to the world. And the reason most of them end up being wrong is because they start off just as math. They're mathematical formulations. They're not scientific formulations yet because we haven't tested them. The intention is to test them. But at the time, they're just self-consistent mathematical frameworks.
The underlying mathematical frameworks have been tested. So you have, let's say something in my field, you could go into theoretical biophysics. So how proteins should behave. So we know, we have a certain mathematical understanding of the behavior of polymers in solutions and stuff. And we could say, okay, based on this known framework, we can compute certain consequences. So we could assume that based on what we know, what can happen under these conditions? And we can compute the consequences and see what happens. Okay, is it possible for a protein to fold in a certain way into this configuration? You can then set up certain experiments that can test it. If the experiments show that no, it can't, then you throw out that framework. Mm-hmm. But all these frameworks are based on an underlying scientific bedrock. They are not based on just the whims of a
scientist. But you know, at any given, like say at this moment, at this present moment, there are competing theoretical physical theories out there that are each self-consistent with themselves. They're consistent with themselves, and they're consistent with the scientific consensus that we have. But they're competing theories because they're not consistent with each other. And what we need to do is do the science to figure out which one
aligns more with experiment.
And that's, again, which one aligns more with experiment, right? Which one is better at explaining the real world? Yeah.
Again, because they're all approximations.
They're all approximations. And even any measurements we do will be, not perfect. And it's not, any theory we have will just, it's about being approximately true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another thing, you know, let me just keep going back to this class because I took a little bit of issue with the way it was framed. So one of the examples he tried to give examples about scientific theories and what he called unscientific theories, which again, I take issue with because you aren't creative enough to come up with the experiment doesn't mean it's not scientific. But anyway, so let's just go with what he said. So scientific and unscientific. And he gave two theories as examples of one that is scientific and one that is unscientific. And I took issue with them. So one was, he said, here, this is the theory, okay? Or the hypothesis. There are centaurs on planet Earth.
Okay.
Okay, so is that a scientific theory? Well, it's a scientific theory if you can do an experiment to verify or falsify it. So I would say, yeah, that could be a scientific theory. I mean, it's false, but it's a scientific theory. You run the experiment, you look for centaurs, or you figure out if there were centaurs. Oh, by the way, centaurs are mythical creatures. People know that, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, they're these, I don't even actually know, but they're mythical. but if, you know, okay, if there are centaurs on planet Earth, then I should be able to see them. And even if I can't see them, then what else should I see on planet Earth if there were centaurs? Maybe I see their trails or whatever else, right? So it is a scientific theory because it could be verified or falsified. And he agreed, he said that. But he gave another one, another hypothesis that he said was unscientific, but I very much took issue with. He said, centaurs are either brown or orange. And he said that this is unscientific. And the reason he said this is unscientific is because there are no such thing as centaurs. To which I said, whoa, wait a second. First of all, we don't know there's no such thing as centaurs because that is anti-science. We don't know, we think, right? So that doesn't mean that hypothesis is unscientific. You can do the experiment. You can look for centaurs and see if they're brown or orange. If you don't find centaurs, that means they don't exist. And that means that statement is not true because not only that they're not brown or orange, it's that they just don't exist. Right. And I felt like we were just playing, not playing with words. I always say this where you just end up playing with words.
No, but you're completely right. Yeah. Like,
why is that unscientific?
It isn't in the sense of what the definition of science is. What is wrong with saying there are centaurs or centaurs can only be orange or red? Or orange or brown or whatever, is that it's a bad explanation. It can be easily varied. So it's not like if I was to say that the Earth doesn't revolve around the sun or the moon doesn't revolve around the Earth, that's testable, even though I'm completely wrong.
Yeah,
I could wait till the morning to see if the sun comes up, or I can wait to see if I see the moon in the sky.
Yeah.
Just because I make a claim doesn't a idiotic claim doesn't mean it's not a scientific claim. It's a scientific claim because I can test it.
Yeah, but he was saying you can't test it because there are no such thing as centaurs. Which I again, and then I didn't bring this up. I mean, I did. I mean, I'm not even in this class, and I'm putting up my hand and causing trouble. But anyway, he's using the premise that there are no such thing as centaurs to say that hypothesis is unscientific. The one that centaurs are either orange or brown. But I can use that same premise that there are no such thing as centaurs to say that the other hypothesis, the one that there are centaurs on planet Earth, is unscientific because I know there are no centaurs on Earth. Like, it's cyclical, right? Like, he's using actually the first hypothesis that there are no centaurs to say, which he considers a scientific question, a scientific theory, to say that the other one's unscientific. But actually, no. If one's scientific, then the other one's also scientific.
The axioms of his,
yeah.
Or the assumptions he's making for both of them self-contradictory each other. Yeah.
And that's why I say I don't like the word to say that a theory is unscientific. I think you never know if it's unscientific. I agree that to be scientific, that means you can do the experiment and you can verify or falsify it, right? But I don't agree that just because you can't come up with the experiment means it's unscientific. Just because you give me a list of theories, there's no way I'll be able to say and which of them are unscientific, because just because I didn't come up with, couldn't figure out what the experiment would verify or falsify, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Like the other example he gave was this hypothesis was the Earth was created by God, and he said this is unscientific. And I don't believe in God or anything, right? We talked about this in the first episode, but that to me is, I'm not saying that's a scientific theory. I don't know. I don't even know what he meant by God, right? Like maybe first you have to tell me what God is and all that kind of stuff. But that just because you haven't come up with the experiment doesn't mean it's not scientific, right? And in that particular example is important. It's important to think about because it shows that you actually, if you're going to come up with a theory that you want it to be scientific, and you want to check if it's scientific, well, you have to be clear what you mean. What do you even mean by God? If you mean that it's this omnipresent thing that does it, I don't know, that it just controls the universe.
Yeah,
that's unscientific, I agree. But then you have to clarify what you mean, right? Like if you think, if you define God as just a body of statements that are never falsified, I don't know. We're really getting out there, but my point is, how do you know? Like, he didn't know that was such. He was partitioning hypotheses into scientific and unscientific. And my quibble was that putting some of those into unscientific category was the most anti-scientific thing to do, because it said that you knew, and that is very anti-scientific. That you to say that I know. Like no, not that, like, you know, when we say, oh, the Earth revolves around some, we know that. Yes, okay, we know that, but there's a qualifier that, you know, anything's possibly wrong. But he was saying, no, this is unscientific. I know that it's unscientific, and I'm not going to use science to answer it. And I said, no, wait, that's not true. Maybe it's not worth it, and you try really hard, and you get nowhere with it, so you give up and you go on. Great. Calling it unscientific is the most anti-scientific thing to do, because it says that you know, right?
Yes.
It says that, not that you know in the sense that you've done the experiment a million times, anyway. I mean, you know in the sense that you're 100% sure, like, this is how it works, which is my main quibble with a lot of, like, religious arguments. It's the premise is that you know, right? Where the scientific view is that, no, I don't know, actually. Let's start with I don't know and figure out what I can. That's science. The science is, I don't know. Let's figure out what works.
Yeah.
Right? And it may not work forever, but it's working for now. Right?
Exactly.
Anyways, so that's the class. I think I'm gonna go next week. I think I'll keep going. It was actually interesting. The one I went to a few days ago, which was on, it was way more philosophical, it was less scientific. It was talking about, I don't know, semantic things that, it wasn't necessarily hard to follow, but I just felt it wasn't. I know I'm sounding condescendingly dismissive, and I don't mean to be, but I just didn't feel. I didn't feel like I got much out of that lecture. So I'll keep going. Report back to how those people think about it, how we think about it. I mean, to be clear, that's not what we're trying to do here in this podcast. We're trying to narrow down how science is done today and how we think about science today. Not necessarily. Oh, you know, the lecture I went to today, he was talking pretty much all about Immanuel Kant and his approach to science, and some other German guy that I should know his name. But we're trying, and so we're not trying to give, like, a synopsis of what people thought in time necessarily. We're just trying to figure out what is the best way to think about science today. And that's another thing, like, the scientific approach, the scientific way to approach this problem is that even in the future, we may adjust our process, right? We'll say, actually, you know, we can do this other way of figuring out what's true, at least approximately. You know, yes. What I mean? Like, yeah, we're trying to describe the scientific method here and the mathematical method, of course, but the scientific method here and how it works. But, you know, even that's up for debate in the future. Maybe that'll even change, right? We don't know. We don't even know what we, you know, we have, we don't even know that we don't know.
Yeah, there are no.
Or the process that we go about not knowing things. We don't know that the process we go about to figure out what we don't know, we don't know that that's how it works.
There are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and then there are unknown unknowns.
No, we meta don't know. We don't know, but we also don't know that we don't know. Yeah. Right? We're not sure. That to me is science, right? That nothing, like, we're everything. We don't know everything. We just have the best snapshot of how we think it works right now, and we're trying to get better every day, and that's it.
Exactly.
And nothing, when we categorize, quote, categorize things, they're never permanently categorized that way. Maybe we'll change our mind in the future. That's just, you know, us being dumb apes trying to figure out this place.
Exactly.
Okay. So I hope we went on a rant there about the philosophy of science class that I attended, but I hope we explain better what we mean by math, the mathematical method and the scientific method, and how they work together and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So philosophy of science, it's quite a contemptuous topic with respect to a lot of scientists, especially mm-hmm. popularizers of science. I don't think a lot of people specifically in science understand exactly what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of crap in it, but yeah, there's a lot of really good stuff in it as well. The philosophy of science is really, really good at trying to make scientists frame very difficult questions properly.
And frame their hypothesis so that they can be falsified.
Yes.
Right?
Where the divide comes is on what all the abstract ideas mean, mm-hmm. what the underlying theories of falsification are, how the scientific method should work. Mm-hmm. That's all pure philosophy, and scientists on a whole,
they don't care. Do you think they should, or do you think that these kind of questions should be advanced by scientists and not necessarily the philosophers that sit and think about science? I'm not a scientist, for example, right? And I'm not a philosopher of science either, but I do think way more about the philosophy of it than actual. Actually, that's not true either. But anyways, I do think about the philosophy of it way more than I think other people. But do you think it should be left up to those people that do think about the philosophy of it, or do you think actual scientists that are in labs?
I think it should be both. In the sense that I think science in and of itself right now works well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it can be better, but the scientific method, insofar as it's taught in high school and stuff, is not precisely how it's done in the real world. Mm-hmm. It's an approximation for how scientists do experiments.
Mm-hmm.
But
what do you mean? They're just doing experiments to falsify theories, right?
Yes, yes, yes. But it's not like the framework of the way they teach it in high school is you come up with a hypothesis, you come up with an experiment, test the hypothesis, go back. It doesn't really work. It's not that easy. It's not that simple. It's not that clear cut. It's come up with a hypothesis, do an experiment. Oh, something went wrong. Got to go. It's more like a spider's web than a step-by-step process.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the field of pure philosophy, how they want to, if they can come up with a new framework that works better than what we're doing now, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But insofar as things are going now, the how we're doing things, a scientist, in my experience, does not think about the philosophy of science when he's in the laboratory.
Right. But I think, this is what I think. I think theoretical scientists, like theoretical physicists, very much do think about
The
philosophy. I think they're at the actually leading edge of the philosophy of science.
I think the
few things that I do read by philosophers of science that I find the better work is done by theoretical physicists. I think Feynman was a way better philosophy of science than a lot of other, quote, philosophy of science.
Yes,
right?
Because the way they deal, it's because it's more intrinsic to their field.
Yeah.
Experimental physicists, experimental chemists, experimental biologists only really deal with 80% of what they do or 70% of what they do is in experiment, and the rest is in theory. Those who only go towards the theoretical and do no experiments are more intertwined with philosophy, because since they cannot do experiment to readily test their theories, you require a better and more rigorous philosophical framework to ask the right questions, to be able to come up with a better mathematical rigor and so on, to be able to try to figure out if what you are trying to explain even begins to make any sense, or the questions you're posing may make any sense. For example, if we take the assumption that time started at the Big Bang, therefore merely asking the question what came before the Big Bang does not make any sense, because there was no time or anything before the Bang.
Until you create some sort of framework where there's something beyond time or whatever.
You require the philosophy.
And this is why theoretical physicists need to, I think they think about this a lot, and they need to think about this a lot, because if they're coming up with new theories, these theories have to be, they have to be scientific, right?
Yes.
They can't be, you can't, and I don't know much about string theory or anything like that, but one of the complaints I heard other people say about string theory is that it's not falsifiable. You can't do these experiments. And I think, well, then why am I wasting my time?
It's not that it's not falsifiable. It's not it is falsifiable.
In principle, but just not easily.
In principle, we cannot go to the energies that require.
I see. So I don't know. And we talked about that a bit, but I'm not sure. So what is your take on that? So you have a theory that in principle is falsifiable. So in principle, it's scientific. I'll agree with that. But is this something that people should be spending their time on if the experiment is just not at all?
Yes.
Feasible? You think it is?
It's not feasible right now, but it might be feasible 50 years from now. So a lot of experiments, you'll find that there's a general trend in science where once a theory is postulated, if that theory is correct, it takes about 40 to 70 years.
The really big ones.
Yes, the really big ones for the experiments to come and show that this is true.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that time frame might be longer, but you should not in any way hinder a scientist from asking these questions anyway.
Totally.
It's not going to harm anyone, and they might be right in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah.
They might be wrong. The majority of them might be wrong.
Yeah.
But at least even if they are wrong, you can still, where they are wrong, you can kind of build on something new. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't do any harm to postulate these questions anyway. They're good mental exercises. They're good for the scientific community as a whole.
And really, on it, you know, this sounds funny, but really good mathematics is a lot of the time developed because of those. And even if the theory doesn't turn out to be true, you really have this toolkit of really good mathematics that can now be readily applied to other areas.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it is a good exercise.
An example of that is Ed Witten. He's the only physicist to have a Fields Medal.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And he is a mathematical physicist, and I don't know the exact math, but he's developed a lot of new mathematics based on physical frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these things can come about it. And he specializes in M-theory.
Okay. So M-theory is a superset of string theory.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's a higher order, Okay. Next episode, we'll actually sit and do a new topic for once. There are lots of things I think we can talk about that are interesting, and we can apply math and science to them and wrap our heads around them. Okay, so I think that's it for now. We'll be back next time with an actual new topic and something that's new and interesting. Until then, goodbye.
Take care.